that and replace them with something a little bit more robust. Case 2, QIQ.
Hey, that's a beauty, Glenn. Yes. After a certain number of years of time, a fuse can develop weird kinds of intermittence. Wouldn't it be nice if just replacing the fuse holder and or fuse made this all go away? I think there's a 50-50 chance you're going to hit pay dirt on that one, Steve. KC2MPP, K2RIW in the tech band.
Dick, first, before anything, just replace the fuses.
Without a doubt. Wouldn't that be nice if that did it? Go ahead, Steve.
Yes, it'd really be nice. What's a couple of fuses cost? You know, $2 at the local Radio Shack? That would be great. Back to you.
And if that does it, you owe Greg a piece of pizza. I'm having some fun with you. Because fuses can do that. And can you imagine how much searching inside the radio with troubleshooting might take place as opposed to something that simple? And you've heard the case of a mic situation once when a Kenwood R7000, I think it was, Kenwood 700, anyhow, it was owned by Harry Donalds. I borrowed it from him, recognized a crazy characteristic, and thought I would fix it for him and started doing some troubleshooting. And I spent a week looking for all kinds of things. And the first thing I should have done is to find out, were the voltages correct at the power supplies? And I would have saved an awful lot of grief. And so here you don't even have to open up the box if it's just a fuse on the outside. And fuses can do that. Let's hope that's it. And come back and tell us the good news or the bad news, Steve. KC2MDP for any other comment. K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, that I will. Yes, I'll measure the voltage at the battery. I'll measure the voltage with the car off, the car on. I'll measure voltage at the actual feed point to the radio itself. Then I'll measure it when it's in receive, and I'll measure it with it in transmit. I'll replace the fuses, and I'll see what happens. And hopefully next week I can let you know the results. Back to you.
Case 2 QIQ with one more comment.
I'm glad you said what you said, Steve. The crazy intermittence of the fuse is something your voltmeter might not show to you because it's a microsecond event. Just replace those fuses, make sure you've got good contact on those fuse connectors. Even before you make any measurements, just go replace those fuses. It's academic as to exactly how bad they are. But the fuse can give you a crazy microsecond at a time intermittent that'll drive you crazy, and you might not be able to see it with normal instrumentation. KC2QIQ, K2LAW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, the only other comment, Dick, was that generally, if the car's battery or alternator start having problems, you'll start seeing that in other ways. The headlights won't be operating properly, the car won't start, the computer will get all messed up in the car. All kinds of terrible things usually happen if the battery and the alternator are bad. Usually a radio is something way down the line. But I've seen this with the ICOM. As a matter of fact, it's not just the ICOM 7000. There's quite a few of the ICOM mobiles that I don't know what in the world, what kind of fuses they got. But just replace them first and see if that fixes it. But I think in the long term, you may want to just, you know, if that does fix the problem, you might not have to do any chain touch the fuses for quite some time after that, but you may want to put, you know, cut out the fuse holder and put something in a little bit more robust. Case 2 QIQ.
Comment 2 also, Dick.
John recognized. There's a slim possibility here, Steve, that ICOM went to Brand X, the low bidder on the fuses, and got a brand of fuses that have this crazy intermittent that develops after a short period of time. So fuse replacement first, even before you do any further measurements. Worry a little bit about whether or not the big, great big clamps at the terminals of the battery of the automobile, make sure they're making good contact. Once in a blue moon, they can give you flaky contacts and give you crazy characteristics. But that's a long shot. Now that I'm remembering, a fuse can do this. And it's who would believe that something as simple as that can create intermittent microsecond-like problems? KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Dick, we used to have
problems like this on some of the equipment that had a lot of vibration, some of the big structures. And the only way, and you're right, if you measure that voltage at the radio, not going to do it. But if you set your digital meter on the milliamp scale or millivolt scale and measure the voltage across the fuse, you will see it. You'll be able to detect that failure.
Yeah, that's a good point. A set of oscilloscope probes and or millivolt meter across the fuse. The voltage drop across the fuse should be a very low voltage. But that's getting down to the academic level. I think they bought a brand of fuse that was the low bidder, that used materials that had dissimilar metal problems that develop at some time downrange. The automobile has significant vibrations, significant temperature variations, significant humidity variations, and when you're using the radio in the sideband mode, the current flowing through the fuse is going up and down in all kinds of crazy ways. You're doing a life cycle test to a chunk of material that's inside that fuse when you use it in that environment, Steve. And it's time that this $1 item called fuse, you replace both of them, and I think there's a high probability you're going to be quite happy. Okay. Let's see. I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in. And now, should we go to Paul? Should we go to the mailbag? John, you'll be there. Oh, go to that question you're about to ask. Your choice. Maybe mailbag is the right thing we should go to next, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2AZ.
AZ, you have a question on one of the questions, on one of the subjects that we have on the floor. Go ahead.
No, I had a quick question on propagation.
Okay, yeah. You're signing in after the list, so to speak. We're going to have to go through our other menu and then come back to you. Is that okay?
I'll probably have to catch you next week then.
I have a question. Maybe we could go to the scalar waves to have it done, and then we could go further.
Negative on that. AC2AZ, where you signed in late, and you're going to come back next week. You're going to be number one on the runway next week if you sign in. AC2AZ, give us your handle. I'll make sure you're number one on the runway next week. Go ahead, AC2AZ.
Okay, Dick. It's Bob. The handle's Bob. AC2AZ. Questions about propagation. Basically, some bizarre propagation here on the HF band. So I'll catch you next week on that topic.
I should remember. Are you Bob Benwood? Have I got the right guy?
You have the right guy.
Terrible the way I'm treating you, and the way I'm so forgetful. I know you're not going to be able to hang in there late enough tonight. There's a chance we can get to you, but you're going to be number one on the runway next week. And propagation is a great subject. And by the way, if you take a look at the January issue of QST that just arrived, and if you look at the Doctor is In section, and you look at question number one, you're going to see a explanation of high-frequency propagation a hell of a lot better than anything you've ever read before. So once again, look forward to January 2015, QST Magazine, The Doctor is In, question number one, where a person's asking about how come the propagation on 15 meters is so good periodically, even though the sunspot cycle is so low. And there's a real good expert that gave an explanation on that one, and you want to read that section. I wonder if your question on propagation was going to be on HF propagation, Bob. AC2AZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, it's on HF propagation. You guys are on till midnight, so maybe I'll catch you if I can get back on before midnight. No, it's basically listening to Weedback stations and listening to this bizarre phenomena. I've got a recording for you, actually. Can't hear the actual original modulation. It just sounds like this very bizarre whining, machining sound back and forth, and I picked this up on several stations on 4 and 6 megahertz, so I just wanted to play it for you, and, but we'll catch you a little bit later this evening or maybe next week. I'll let you guys continue with your mailbag.
Yeah, we're later than we've ever been on the mailbag, and in theory, the mailbag is the guys that have to go to bed early because they go to school the next day. John, KC2WGB, one of those geniuses asking you these days. You got it, John, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB, good evening to everyone on the TechNet. Yeah, we're running a little late, but I've got only two quick ones here, which should be easy. I have a question concerning balance, and basically it's a one-to-one balance. And this gentleman is asking if the use of a one-to-one balance can interfere with the forward-going RF, as it chokes off the return RF, eliminating that hotline. Does it affect the forward-going? He'd like an explanation on that, if you'd like to do that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
It's a good question, and the answer is, it depends. It's not a yes or a no. Let me give you a couple of examples. If I'm using coaxial cable as my transmission line, and I'm feeding a dipole, and I'm not using any kind of a balance, you guys have heard some of the story before. The typical guy will take the center conductor, connect it to the right side of the dipole, the shield, he connects it to the left side. On paper, it looks pretty good if you're a little bit naive. That thing you call dipole, you think it's one single antenna, and you think you're feeding it in the center. Mother Nature doesn't look at it that way. That half-wave dipole to Mother Nature is a quarter-wave dipole on the right, a quarter-wave monopole on the right, and a quarter-wave monopole on the left. Even though in the center, in the ideal world, you measure, let me pick a number, 70 ohms of resistive impedance when the dipole is just the right length and it's resonant, to Mother Nature, it is a 35-ohm monopole to the right with reference to ground, and a 35-ohm monopole to the left with reference to ground. And now I'm talking about a mysterious thing that I call radio ground. Doesn't necessarily depend on whether or not your dipole is 30 feet above the earth or 300 feet above the earth. You're going to get this exact same phenomenon. If you're an astronaut in space, you're a mile behind, you're floating in space with your spacesuit, you're a mile behind the space shuttle, and you're firing up this dipole, and you do some careful measurements. The right side of the dipole is a 35-ohm resistor to the rest of the universe, and the left side is a 35-ohm resistor to the rest of the universe. Let me drop. So the antenna itself is balanced, but you're feeding it with an unbalanced transmission line. That coaxial cable should have, under the ideal world, all the signal is on the center conductor, and the voltage is flowing between the center conductor and the inner surface of that outer shield. On the forward-going signal, there is no signal on the outside of the coax cable. But once that signal hits the dipole, and the dipole is going to force a balance, so that if at this instant of time there's plus 10 volts on the right side of the dipole, there's going to be minus 10 volts on the left side of the dipole. Mother Nature is going to move you in that direction. That's the way she treats that antenna. Therefore, because of the way the antenna behaves, that antenna will, with the, in my example, 10 volts on the left side of the dipole, which is the one you connect to the shield, it's going to be launching a 10-volt signal down the outside of that coax cable. And when that signal flowing down the outside comes into the shack, you might have RF in the shack, you might create a little bit more television interference because that cable runs by some other piece of electronics in the house. Let me drop. And that phenomenon that I just described is one of the causative agents that causes a huge mystery with a lot of the guys on HF frequencies. There's a whole bunch of guys saying that if I choose the magic length of coax cable, odd number of quarter wavelengths, an even number of half wavelengths, they got all kinds of theories. If I choose the magic length of cable, standing wave ratio goes away. They believe that. Because when they change the length of the transmission line, because RF energy is flowing down the outside of the cable, and it's connected to the dipole, that means the outside of your transmission line is part of that antenna. Changing the length of the transmission line will change the resonant frequency of your antenna, because it's connected electronically to that outer shield, and that outer shield is a length that is or isn't resonant. So you change the length of the cable, and you'll see that there's one change because of this common mode phenomena of signal flowing down the outside. You put the right kind of a balancing device right at the dipole. The balancing device acts like an RF choke only to the outside. The signal flowing down the inside of the cable doesn't know it's going through a one-to-one balance. it can't tell. But because that one-to-one balance, if you use it correctly, and it could be a poor man's balance, just a few turns of coax cable taped together near the dipole, acting as an electrode. If you can stop the signal from flowing down the length of your transmission line, then this cable length phenomenon goes away. You change the length of the transmission line, your VSWR doesn't change. So does the balun affect signal flowing forward? Yes, but indirectly. You're changing the tuning of the antenna when you've got a hot piece of cable, and you're changing the length of the cable. This is not the whole story, but it's enough to get you on the right track to understanding this phenomenon. And boy, does this create controversy on the HF frequencies. I bet you if I did a survey, I would find out that 90% of the hams are absolutely positive. You can change the VSWR by changing the length of your cable. And they've seen this happen on their bird watt meter. They watch the needle move and they change the length of the cable, and they say, aha, the VSWR goes up and down as they change length of cable. When you have the right kind of a balancing device, that phenomena disappears. And John has been doing some experiments to try to confirm or deny this, and we're not quite through with that one yet. KC2WGV, K2LIW in the deck mask.
Yes, Dick, this balancing issue, the balance seemed to cause a lot of confusion. So I thought that question was interesting, and I've got about three of them this week, basically the same question on those. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one.
Third question?
Stand by, John. Identify yourself, call letters, and name. Go ahead with your question on that subject.
Hi there, it's Victor Echo 3, X-Ray Sierra Hotel, Christian in Toronto. I had a quick question regarding the previous answer, and it was that after listening, I think I understand the meaning of Q, but I'm wondering if you could give me a definition of VSWR, because I've heard you use the word a couple of times, and I'd just love to know your definition. Thank you.
Yeah, that is related. VSWR, voltage standing wave ratio. And it's called standing wave ratio because in the old days, either by way of a set of electro wires, it's an open wire transmission line, and you put some kind of a detecting device, like a neon light bulb, between the two wires, and you move it along the wires and recognize the fact that the light bulb is bright in some places and dim in others, or in the case of a slotted line, you move the little probe along the carriage, and you see the voltage go up and down on your detector that's on that piece of sensing wire that goes down between the slotted lines. So standing wave ratio is either with the electro wires or the slotted line, it is the ratio of peak to valley voltage or peak to valley current that you see with either one of those testing devices. Now, where does the peak and valley come from? Because the probe on the slotted line is a non-directional detector, it doesn't know the difference between the signal flowing forward and the signal flowing back. If your transmission line is terminating with an antenna that's, say for instance, using 50 ohm transmission line, and if your antenna at that operating frequency was a pure 50 ohm resistive load and no reactance, then all the signal flowing down the transmission line goes into the antenna, gets radiated to space, and absolutely none of it comes back. Let me drop. If the antenna is anything but a 50 ohm pure resistor, in my example, if it's a 55 ohm resistor or a 49 or 45 ohm resistor, or if it has any amount of inductive reactance or capacitive reactance in the impedance of the antenna, by a very easily used formula, you can calculate exactly what percentage of the signal you send up that cable will be reflected by the antenna and it comes back down. Any amount of signal coming back down the cable as a reflectance will create what you measure as a standing wave ratio. In reality, Mother Nature does something really magic here. The signal flowing forward on the cable and the signal flowing in reverse on the cable, Mother Nature does not mix them together. They are two thoroughly independent events, even though they came from the same transmitter and they reflected off the same antenna. Mother Nature does not differentiate between those two. That's a hard one to accept. But when you use a non-directional sensing probe,
that looks at the forward signal, looks at the reverse signal, and in the probe it mixes them together. And now, at the place where you see a peak in voltage, those two voltages are in phase. And where you see a valley of voltage, those two voltages are out of phase. The probe mixed them together for the first time. Now you see this phenomenon we call standing wave ratio. In reality, Mother Nature does not mix those signals together. The signals that are flowing up and down your cable do not mix. All those signals that are in the room from you, flowing from north to south from one broadcast station, and east to west from another broadcast station, those signals fold right through each other with absolutely no interaction. The propagating medium does that. That's some of the magic of the so-called pointing vector. So, you've heard a partial definition. And now the Q of an antenna, that's another area we can get pretty deep into, which I think we're going to with John's question a little bit later. But at least you've got a partial explanation of standing wave ratio. It is the ratio of forward power to reverse power. You use your Berg wattmeter, you measure the amount of forward power, you measure the amount of reverse power, then you know the apparent standing wave ratio at that point of measurement in the shack, we'll say, on your transmission line. You use the forward and reverse power ratio, plug it into a formula, it will calculate standing wave ratio, which, by the way, is a function of the square root of that ratio. 1 plus the square root, 1 minus the square root of the ratio that is the standing wave ratio, the ratio of forward to reverse power. Maybe that helps a little bit. You're going to have to hear this a couple of times, read it a couple of times before it makes sense. There's a little more to the story, Christian, but it's a good one that you asked. V3, X-ray Sierra Hotel in the Toronto area. KTRIW in the TechNet.
Repeat and the term.
Christian, are you still there, or did we time out the machine and also time you out? V3XSH, KQRIW, go ahead, Christian.
Hi there, Dick. Yeah, I guess since the last minute or so, there was some sort of weird timeout, but yeah, thanks for your answer. I can tell I've just sort of scratched the surface of something, and I'll just keep listening in. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to try to give you a quick synopsis of the last minute. So that signal flowing forward and the signal flowing back on the cable, and the signal flowing back is because of an impedance mismatch at the antenna. Any impedance mismatch from 50 ohm resistor at the antenna will give you some reflected power. That forward and reflected power, the transmission line keeps them thoroughly separate. In your slotted line, you're mixing them together for the first time in that probe. And now you see a peak and a valley in voltage. That peak and valley is not really there. There's a forward-going signal, which is a pure sine wave, equal in amplitude, everywhere along the cable. There's a reverse signal, because of standing wave ratio. There's a signal flowing back down your cable, which was equal in amplitude everywhere along the cable. And the forward-going signal and the reverse-going signal do not mix together in any way. I'm reasonably sure that is an absolute truth. You say those words on 20 meters, and the majority of people hearing you will say, you're crazy, what in the world are you saying? I can measure that standing wave ratio on a slotted line. Well, your slotted line created what you think is a peak and a valley of voltage and standing wave ratio. You drop a pebble into the north side. Let me drop a...
If you took QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized. You drop a pebble into the north side of a pool of water. You watch the wave goes to the south. You drop a pebble into the south side of a pool of water. Watch the waves going to the north. Drop two pebbles like that simultaneously. As long as the waves are small enough that you're not creating white caps, those two sets of waves fold through each other with no interaction. Mother Nature does that on a propagating medium. I can also do this with the guide wire on my radio tower. I tap the guide wire, I watch a pulse go up, hit the tower, which is a short circuit, reverse in polarity and come back down. So while the pulse is coming back down the guide wire, and I tap the guide wire again and make another pulse going back up, I can watch those two pulses fold through each other with no interaction. Ain't that crazy? KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Hey,
I just wanted to ask you a question about clarification on something, if you don't mind, because I do have a reflection test set and a polar display and a signal generator here that I can set up at 0 dBm, and I did some length after I heard this discussion initially. Are you interested in some of the results I saw?
Yes, I am, Glenn. And you got to be careful now. If there was any signal flowing down the outside of a coax cable, then the whole system becomes cable length sensitive. But if you've got the right kind of a balance on any kind of a reasonable VISWA on the end of your coax cable, then the VISWA that you see shouldn't change as you change the length of cable, assuming the cable is low in loss. I hope you measured something similar to that, and if you measured a difference from that, then it's time we investigate where is it coming from. KC2QIQ, K2LIW, and protect that.
Yeah, initially what I did was I set up my reflection test set so that I could measure the S11, so I'm looking at VSWR, and I put the, I did the open circuit, and the, of course, I adjusted the reflection test set phase shifter so that the beam would wind up all the way at the left end of the circle, and then I put the short circuit on, it wound up all the way at the right hand side of the circuit, of the circle, and I put a 50 ohm, a 50 dB pad on the end, and it wound up right in, this, right in the middle. Are you with me so far?
Yes, I'm with you, but you said it backwards. The conventional way people set up a Smith chart.
That was my error, Dick.
Okay, so that helps to tell you. The conventional way people set up a Smith chart is 0 ohms is on the far left side, infinite ohms is on the right hand side, and the center of the chart is 50 ohms. And you said it backwards, but you caught your error. Go right ahead, Eric. Glenn.
So resistance is going up on that line on the bottom all the way to the right hand side. So basically then what I did was I took two 50 ohm loads and basically paralleled them to 25 ohms, and after everything was already normalized, I put that on and it wound up at the 25 ohm or just slightly off, you know, along the resistive line. You with me so far?
Sounding beautiful so far, Glenn. Wait for the four beeps, which I didn't do.
Then I went back and I started taking a 100 ohm resistor, and it wound up at the 100 ohm mark, just on the right hand side of 50 ohms, where I would expect it on the resistive line, or pretty darn close to it. Not exact, but very close. So what I tried was, let me put some capacitive reactants in parallel with the 50 ohms. And what it did was it brought it down. So basically, it wound up coming a little bit closer to 50 ohms, but further down on the line. Are you with me so far?
Yes, I am, and I'm going to jump ahead with one. When you put a capacitor in parallel, not in series, you're really into a susceptance chart, not an impedance chart, into an admittance chart is what you're into. If you go through the calculation of what happens when I put a 100 picofarad capacitor in parallel with a 50 ohm resistor, you're going to move into the capacitive direction on the Smith chart, but you're not going to move by the number of ohms you think, because the Smith chart is ordinarily a impedance chart, not an admittance chart. And an admittance chart is sort of upside down. If the capacitor you put was in series with the 50 ohm resistor, which mechanically is hard to do, then it would have moved along the capacitive reactance line on the chart in a more predictable manner. When you put it in parallel on an impedance chart, you're getting a weird kind of interaction, is one way of looking at it, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Very good. We're on the same page. So now what happened was when I had the 50 ohms and I started adjusting the phase shifter, it stayed pretty much on 50 ohms. It really didn't move much at all. I mean, there was some small, variation around 50 ohms, but very, very little. And when I looked at 25 ohms, which was just to the left of 50 ohms on the Smith chart, and I started adjusting the phase shifter, it started moving around, basically, the 50 ohms from the 25 ohm mark, but still staying the same amount away from 50 ohms. And when I did the open circuit and the closed circuit, it would basically stay all the way on the outside, but as I was changing the phase it would basically just move around the circle, but in magnitude, it was always staying the same amount away from 50 ohms. Are you with me?
Yes and no. Depending on which brand of vector network analyzer you're using, whether it be Agilent, Hewlett-Packard, or Rohde & Schwarz, the so-called phase shifter really is, you can go to a sub-program where you shift the apparent phase of display, and depending on where it does it in its computer program, you can get different results. If you were really phase shifting in a pure manner by way of a trombone 50-ohm line, now you would be walking around, you'd be drawing a circle where you put your compass, the sharp point, in the center of the 50-ohm point, and you're drawing a circle, if you were doing it in that manner. But the way internally with the microprocessor, each of these brands do phase shifting, and there's multiple ways you can do phase shifting, you can get different kinds of results. You've got to be careful how you interpret them. They can be confusing, Eric Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LIW, and the TechNet.
Okay, let me re-describe the setup again. This is not a vector network analyzer. This is a HP Polar display with a reflection test set box with the phase shifter built in. So, and I'm using an external signal generator. It's a Wiltron. And I was basically doing this at, I think it was at 900 megahertz. That's where I started, Dick. Are you with me so far?
Yes, I am. And no matter what words are written on the front panel, that thing you are using, in my mind, is a vector network analyzer, even though it uses different words. You were electronically measuring forward power and reverse power, be careful now, forward voltage and reverse voltage as a vector, amplitude and phase. Your machine was, in theory, measuring phase and voltage going forward, phase and voltage coming back, and then putting it onto a polar display. That really is a vector network analyzer in my mind, Eric. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Agreed, but as I said, I don't think it has the same problems as you were describing before with a true vector network analyzer with the internal generator. In other words, this one, because I couldn't get it to operate properly on single frequency, and the exact reasons where this one was having the effect, where when I did add the trombone and different lengths of cable, you could see the outer circle into an open, stay on the outside, but just move around the circle, and the same thing with the short circuit. You with me so far?
That's a beautiful test as a kind of a Cal procedure you just described. Go right ahead, Glenn, and wait for the beeps.
Then I went back, checked my 50 ohms, I checked 25 ohms, checked 100 ohms along the resistive line. But now what happened was, I'm going to mention what happened when I started doing the 50 ohms. The 50 ohms, there's very, very little deviation at all in the center when I started adjusting the phase length. When I went to 100 ohms, it started moving around the 50 ohms as I adjusted the phase, but still stayed the same magnitude away. You with me so far?
That's exactly right. The length of the vector from the center of the chart toward your dot, that represents the magnitude of the voltage coming back from your load, in your case a 25-ohm load, and where along that circle, the constant radius circle, swung from the center, you're putting the sharp point of a compass in the center at the 50-ohm point, and now you're swinging a circle. As you swing that circle, the only thing that's changing is the phase angle of the reflected voltage. And so, what I think you're starting to describe is exactly what I believe you should be seeing. Glenn, go ahead.
We're on the same page. Now we're going to go on probably different pages. Now let's talk about the capacitor in parallel with the resistor. It actually swung down a little bit and came in from 100 ohms when I had the capacitor on there so far without changing any phase length of the cable. You're with me on that one.
I think I am. When you put a capacitor in parallel with a resistor, whether it's a 25-ohm, 50-ohm, or 100-ohm resistor, you put a capacitor in parallel. You're moving down, but in a complicated manner. And by the way, as that capacitor goes to infinity in capacitance, it becomes a short circuit, and you would eventually end up at the far left-hand side at 0 ohms if you had the ability to make that capacitor go to infinity. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
And because it was across the 100-ohm resistor, I selected a couple of capacitors in the box, and I found the capacitor that was around 10 picofarads, but I had to play with a few different ones with the lead length at 900 megahertz, and I got something that gave me a magnitude in parallel with the 100 ohms. Although it was capacitive, looked like the magnitude was about 75 ohms reactive. Are you with me so far?
Because I've done so much work at exactly 900 megs, I'm going through a computer program on my handheld calculator right now. I'm going to find out what 10 picofarads is, and I haven't found the right program yet. Go right ahead, Glenn.
Then I started to adjust phase length. Now, here's what this is where the discrepancy comes in. When I start increasing the phase length on the reactive capacitive with the resistor in parallel, and I start adjusting the phase, it no longer stays at the same magnitude around 50 ohms of 75 ohms. It starts going, sometimes curling in closer when I make the cable shorter than where it was originally normalized, and as I make the cable longer, it actually starts going out towards the 100 ohms and beyond it as it goes around the circle with phase. KC2QIQ, explain that one.
Okay, if I'm using my program correctly, 10 picofarads of pure capacitance with no inductance in its leads at 915. See, I did everything between 902 and 928, so 915 is the center of my world. At 915 megahertz, 10 picofarads is 17.4 ohms of capacitive reactance. If I put a shunting capacitor of 17 ohms, a pretty low number, across a 50, 25, or 100 ohm load. I wonder why, how did you get a 100 ohm load? Putting a pair of 50s in parallel gives you 25. But anyhow, in either case, 17 ohms is a pretty low number. So therefore, your dominant impedance is becoming that capacitor, and the resistor almost doesn't count as much because of the size of that capacitor. 10 picofarads at 900 megs, believe it or not, it's a pretty big capacitor, Glenn. KC2QIQ,
K2LIW. Yeah, it sure is, Dick, and as I said, I think what was happening there, too, is that the lead length and the ESR of this capacitor wasn't looking as like a pure 10 picofarads, and that's why it was selected, just to give me a capacitive component that would bring it in a little bit. But what's interesting is with the reactive loading, when I changed the phase length of the cable, and the resistor, by the way, was just a carbon resistor. So I basically trimmed the carbon resistor across the connector that would basically, across a type N connector, that would give me something that looked very, very close to 100 ohms. But what's interesting is that when I adjusted the phase length in series with this circuit, it no longer stayed the exact magnitude away from 50 ohms anymore. It would curl in and curl out just with phase, not changing frequency. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm slowly in the process of looking for my complex set of equations. 100 ohms of resistance, 17.4 ohms of capacitive reactance in parallel with each other is a crazy impedance. And by the way, when your capacitive reactance is as low as 17 and you have any lead length at all, the lead length is going to give you some series inductance. At 900 megs, that used to be considered a very high microwave frequency. In the old days of ham radio, anything above 100 megs was considered microwave. So your lead length on the capacitor probably is getting close to the point where it becomes a series resonator. If the lead length in inductive reactance and the capacitance equals each other, then at that particular frequency it becomes a short circuit and you get a funny little curlicue on the Smith chart if you were sweeping in frequency. So with your, it sounds to me like your surface mount type of 100 ohm resistor right across the type N connector, as far as series inductance is concerned, I think that was pretty pure. But the way this disc ceramic capacitor, I'm guessing it was, at 10 picofarad, and its lead length, life's getting a little bit more complicated. You're now seeing the degree of difficulty of trying to make a leadless capacitor and a leadless resistor right across a transmission line, but you're getting into that transmission line by way of a type N connector. Life's a little bit complicated. with a time domain reflectometer. You'd be amazed what's really going on there, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
I absolutely agree, Dick. And but what's interesting here is that with the resistive, the magnitude, as I just changed the phase length, was the same. To an open circuit or a short circuit, the magnitude around the outside was always the same. With a reactive load, when I changed the phase length, and the reason I chose 900 megahertz stick was because the reflection test set really that I was using is really good for like 1 gigahertz. It'll give me 720 degrees of phase shift with that reflection test set box, because the reflection test set box and the phase shifter are all built into one piece when it goes back into that polar display. So at 900 megahertz, I still had more than one wavelength. So when I put it like halfway in between, I could go at least 180 degrees either side of my 900 megahertz frequency in terms of phase length. So, but what was interesting was that with the reactive loading, I was seeing a deflection of magnitude more than just phase around the Smith chart circle. KC2QIQ.
Good, yeah. Eric recognized, if I did the mathematics correctly, if you had a pure 10 gigafarad capacitor across a pure 100-ohm resistor, and they're in parallel, and now you want to make a series equivalent of that circuit, the series equivalent is 2.9 ohms of resistance, 16.9 ohms of capacitance. Ain't that crazy? Things in parallel act in a funny way. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
I have a question in terms of what happens to the phase angle. In essence, you're making it integrated. What's going to happen in terms of the phase angle and what's coming back? Because, as you know, your essence is going to be changing the shape of the AC component of what you're measuring. That's just a curious question, because the integral of current, as opposed to the voltage, is, you know, it depends on time current. You're talking about a very, very small value, but at 900 megahertz, it could have a very large effect. K2IW, K2J.
Okay. The phase angle of what comes back is a deterministic thing, thoroughly predictable as long as you really know what you're putting as a load. And how do you calculate that? There is a formula saying that the reflected signal equals the following. Z load minus Z zero, that's on the numerator. The denominator is Z load plus Z zero. And your Z's are a complex number. In other words, you've represented it as a real component and a reactive component for your load. So Z load on top minus Z zero, Z load on the bottom plus Z zero, you do that division. Obeying all the laws of complex mathematics, you get what's called S11. S11, when you understand what you're looking at, is the amplitude of the reflection and the phase angle of the reflection. So as long as you know what your load is, you know what your transmission line impedance is, you can predict exactly what phase angle you're going to get as a reflection. And if you're smart enough with the way you adjust that load, you can make that phase angle anything from 0 to 360 degrees in that reflected signal. Ain't that crazy? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Yeah, but Dick, the question remains, would you expect the magnitude to remain the same with the cable length?
I think the answer is yes. You've got some kind of a complicated load. And if you're really with the world's most ideal trombone, changing nothing but the cable, going back to your point of observation on your room, I'm going to call it network analyzer, where it's looking at the reflection phase angle and reflection magnitude. You should be moving at a constant radius circle around the center of the Smith chart if it was a pure trombone, where the trombone itself has no reactants, and if you really have shielding characteristics of your load. Your load really is a minor antenna, Glenn, believe it or not. You were doing some radiating. Therefore, as you change the length of the trombone, that radiation to the outside of the transmission line was another one of the variables. to really do this correctly, everything should be in a shielded box. And let's see if that makes a little bit of sense to Eric first. KE2EJ, K2LAW in the TechNet.
No, I'm following you, Dick. It's just curious. By inverse, I in essence can derive the same thing by using the antiderivative. Is that not true?
You said invert and you said antiderivative. Let me go back slowly on that. Because he's putting the capacitor and the resistor in series with each other, he has to calculate the capacitor reactance and divide it into one, take the inverse, to convert it into a susceptance, because he's going to put it in parallel. His 100-ohm resistor, he has to divide that into one, which is going to be 0.01 ohms of conductance. Now you represent that as a complex number, real and imaginary. And now you operate on it to figure out what the new impedance is. So putting things in parallel, mathematically, is a little bit nasty if you're not using a calculator, a handheld calculator, for instance, that can handle imaginary and real numbers. So this is all calculatable, but it takes some familiarization to get it right. There's only 10 ways when you do this calculation with a handheld calculator you can get it wrong. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
All right, thanks, Dick. Now, I'm just thinking in terms of actually calculate based on the integral. I'm just trying to visualize it. Turn the thing upside down. If you turn it upside down using the integral, you wind up having the antiderivative. But that's a whole other world in terms of complex numbers. But the original thought was, if I take that sine wave that we're putting into the 50-ohm load, and I put a capacitor across it, it becomes an integrated. So that's got to change the shape of what we're doing, which is going to change the reflection coefficient going back the other direction.
When you say integrator, now I know what you're saying. Yes, if I've got a transmission line, that ordinarily the transmission line goes over to some other piece of electronics. Somewhere in the middle of that transmission line, I hang a capacitor from center conductor to shield. Yes, I have created an integrator. What an integrator really means is it's going to create a phase lag of the signal going through. That's a kind of an integration function. And it's going to create a peculiar kind of frequency sensitivity. As you go to higher frequencies, the magnitude of the signal that flows through gets smaller. As you go to lower frequencies, the signal that goes through gets larger. That's a kind of an integrator function of throughput, of transmissivity. When it comes to reflected signal, can we call that an integrator? I think we can, but I'd much rather than call it an integrator of reflected signal, I would rather use that formula I talked to you about. Load minus Z0 divided by load plus Z0. Take those as complex numbers, rationalize it. Now you know the exact magnitude and the exact phase angle of the reflected signal, the S11. KE2EJ, K2LAW.
Alright, I think I'm following you. I'm closing my eyes and I'm just trying to visualize the formulas that I'm always working with. But the one thing that I got backwards is that as we go higher in frequency, the magnitude is going to be smaller.
The magnitude of the throughput is smaller. The magnitude of the reflection is larger because the capacitor reactance is getting smaller. You're moving in the direction of a short circuit, which means all of the signal, you go to a high enough frequency, all of the signal is reflected. I wonder if you see that one, Eric. Eric, go ahead, K2LAW.
Yeah, I can see that. Normally, at work and the things that I do, we don't dive into it that deeply because, I typically have to use a VNA when I'm analyzing antenna problems or transmission line problems. I've always just, for the hell of it, tried to work out the mathematics, and sometimes I get all stuck with the calculus, but I think I'm following where you're going. So that's beginning to make good sense to me. K2RWK2J.
A person has to hear this a number of times before it makes sense. But now getting back to what Glenn observed, assuming now that the radiation from your loading network was not coming back down the outside of your trombone line, And if your trombone line was a pure 50-ohm trombone, that you're only changing the length of it, then in theory, the display of the reflected signal, the S11, should have been a constant radius circle around the center of the Smith chart. That's what it should have been. The fact that you saw something different suggested that other radiation and reactant things were happening, that moving that trombone was doing more than what you thought it was doing. Assuming that all your instrumentation was telling the truth and was properly calibrated. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yes, Dick, and I have a theory about this. I agree with you that if all was perfect and the impedance of the cable was 50 ohms, unchanged, and the reactance, as we calculated with the equation that you just used, it should have moved around the outer circle. Are you with me so far?
If you only move around the outer circle, all the way at the outer circle, if it's a pure shortwave,
to state that around the impedance, in other words, the same magnitude around the offset of that impedance.
Now you've got it. You only go to the outer perimeter if it's a pure short or open. Other than that, it's somewhere in between, you're drawing a circle. That's what you should have seen. Glenn, go ahead.
That's what I was expecting to see, but that's not what I saw. Okay, now I have a couple of ideas to what I think is happening. If I take the outer connector of that type N, and I were to take a clip lead and clip it to a ground on the generator, a ground on the reflection test set, anything else around, it shifts it all over the place. Are you with me?
Oh boy. When you said the word clip lead, and I'm thinking 900 megs, where the wavelength is somewhere around, what is it, 4.5 inches? No, it's somewhere around 9 inches. What you think is a clip lead, and you think it's a short circuit, to that network analyzer, it's a really great big long inductive length. And the word short circuit takes on some peculiar meanings. And when you try to ground various things in that environment, it's sort of like the guy being on the 10th floor of an apartment building, and he wants to establish a good RF ground at that point. That ain't easy. Over to you, Glenn, K2LIW.
Okay, getting back to the topic again, what I really believe is happening here is that instead of getting the result that we would normally expect, is that we have an offset current because of the capacitive reactance that's in parallel across that resistor. And what's happening is I actually am creating a unbalanced current across the coaxial cable. So I'm not getting the impedance with phase length that I would normally be expecting to see, because now I'm getting an inductive component in my cable that I would not normally expect to see. And my feeling is that when people describe this VSWR effect that they're seeing on HF, are they measuring a different magnitude of VSWR? I think that they really are, Dick. But the reason is because they have an unbalanced current because of the mismatch in the reactive load of the antenna. And by adding the extra length of cable, they're actually adding an inductance, and the cable actually is taking on an inductive reactance, and that is what is really changing the VSWR magnitude at a single frequency. KC2QIQ.
If this was the best of all worlds, Glenn, you would have created a small, six-sided, metallic box right at that type N connector, so that your 100 ohm resistor and your 10 picofarad capacitor are inside of a small shielded structure of, let me pick a number, 1 cubic centimeter. The 1 cubic centimeter structure I just described, six-sided metallic box, would be way too small to be anywhere near cavity resonance at 900 megs. Because it's thoroughly shielded, there is no opportunity for any common mode signal to flow down the outside of the cable. In that environment that I just described, you've got a real forward-going signal hitting your complex load and a real predictable amount of reflected signal in the center of the transmission line. So in that shielded structure, where radiation is impossible, now changing the length of the trombone should move you at a constant radius circle on that Smith chart. Because you were radiating with that partial antenna, you had a leaky dummy load kind of an antenna, and you're radiating some signal to the outside of the trombone, and you're changing the length of the trombone, a hell of a lot more was going on before the display did funny things, assuming the display was all well calibrated to begin with. KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Yeah, but just keeping it back on point again, don't you think that that's what people are seeing? In other words, when they're really describing adding a phase length on a reactive load as like an antenna, it's not 50 ohms, in other words, they've got some VSWR offset, and they're taking the length of cable, and they're actually seeing a true magnitude change on a single frequency. They're probably seeing a very similar effect. That's what I expect they're really seeing, Vic, because I think if they really had like an open circuit on the end or a short circuit on the end, they wouldn't see anything like this. Or if they had something that was a good match and they would have changed the length of cable. But if they have some kind of a reactive mismatch on the antenna and they start adding cable length, I think that because of the radiation parts and the unbalanced currents on the cable, that they actually are going to see a difference in magnitude. KC2QIQ.
Eric recognized, yeah, they're definitely going to see a difference in magnitude. And the difference in magnitude is real. Because in the case of the dipole, the worst case, fed with a pure piece of coax cable and no balancing device, the length of the outside of the shield of your transmission line is part of the antenna. You change that length of that transmission line, you're changing the tuning of that antenna. If this complex load you described was thoroughly shielded, none of that effect occurred. If everything was shielded, there is no common mode signal on a piece of coax cable where the load is thoroughly shielded. Let's make sure that you and I are on the same page with that. If the load was thoroughly shielded, there cannot be any common mode signal on that coaxial transmission line. I wonder if you agree with that one, Glenn. How are you, Glenn? K2LAW?
Yeah, I am, Dick. I'm on the same page with that. As I said, you know, these are, to me at least, somewhat academic things. But I do realize that people on 40 meters and 20 meters are seeing a difference in magnitude. I don't think that they're actually creating a good match. In other words, they may have something like a 3-to-1 VSWR, and by adding some cable length, could they reduce it down to a 2-to-1 or 1.5-to-1? Or if they're having a problem with an antenna tuner finding match, and then by adding some additional cable, could actually make the tuner find a match. I think that that's a real, that's something that's really happening, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Absolutely, that is happening. Now, in that environment, with a dipole-like antenna fed with a raw piece of coax cable and no balance, and he changes the length of that transmission line, tell me what you think is changing, Glenn. Go ahead.
I think the problem with this, Dick, is that there's too many variables. You know, if somebody hangs up a dipole antenna on the outside, and the way that somebody connects up balance, and the way that they're terminating their cables to a tuner, you know, they're not... Sometimes I'll describe something that I think is perfect on the other end, the way I'm describing it, and something gets lost in the sauce. But, you know, with all the variables that are out there, is there maybe one definite, you know, description for what's going on here? I'm not sure, but I think that they really are seeing that change in magnitude, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, let me give you a slightly different example. I've got an ordinary dipole running. The dipole is mechanically exactly a half wavelength long, and it's resonant at my operating frequency. I come along, let's assume now that this is a 40-meter dipole. I come along with a 3-foot-long clip lead, and I connect it to the outer tip of that dipole. Have I changed the resonant length of that dipole? Absolutely. Whether I do it to the left side or the right side doesn't quite matter. I'm changing the resonant length of that dipole by adding that clip lead at the tip. Okay. If I add the clip lead at the center of the dipole, just a little bit to the right of the center insulator, which is a little bit of the left of the center insulator, a 3-foot-long clip lead. Am I changing the resonant frequency of that dipole and its impedance? Absolutely. So a clip lead connected to the center of a dipole is changing it electronically. What's different between that clip lead and the length of the outer shield of the coax cable? If I change the length of the clip lead I'm changing the way I detune the dipole. If I change the length of the coax cable connected to it, I'm changing the electrical length of the dipole. As I change the electrical length of the dipole, I'm changing its impedance. Therefore, the real reflection I'm going to see as an S11 is going to change in magnitude and